The title for this series of two talks is One of God's Masterpieces. I've recently read through the book of Exodus fairly quickly, and I've been struck again by the astonishing way in which God worked in this man. And just before looking at the first two or three chapters, we're not going to look at the verses in detail, but just pick out one or two salient points from these chapters. A comment about the whole way in which the Bible approaches a man's life. There is an amazing contrast between worldly biography and Christian biography. They're done in a completely different way. It's important to see the distinction, because this will help you as you do your reading. The concern of the biblical biography is to point a man to God. The concern of the worldly biographer is to point you to a man. Those are different aims. Because of the different aims, you'll see differences in the method. Notice two particular things about the biblical biography. First of all, the Bible never attempts to fill in the gaps in a man's life. An example of this will be found in Exodus chapter 2, verses 10 and 11. The child has been picked out of the bulrushes, and the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, that is his mother, and he became her son, and she named him Moses, for she said, "Because I drew him out of the water." One day when Moses had grown up, he went out to his people and looked on their burdens, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people. Now, look at verse 10, then. Here you have Moses in the first two or three months of his life. He's just been weaned. He's just been named. Where is he in verse 11? Well, it's obvious that he's grown up. A good many years have elapsed. How many years? The answer comes from Acts chapter 7, verse 23. It's often worth comparing the New Testament descriptions of men with the Old Testament. Fascinating sidelights on their character come out that way. Here is Stephen's speech to the Sanhedrin, what he has to say about the great man of the past. Acts 7:22-23. He says, "And Moses was instructed in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, and he was mighty in his words and deeds. When he was 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the sons of Israel. And seeing one of them being wronged, he defended the oppressed man." When he was 40 years old, 40 years have elapsed between verse 10 and verse 11. And not a word is mentioned about that period. When the world approaches a man like Moses, it's very unhappy about that gap. Have you seen the film of the Ten Commandments? All sorts of little fictitious details are inserted. There's a romance in the palace. One of the princesses falls for Moses when he's a young man. You have to have that sort of thing in a worldly biography, or else it won't sell. Not so in a biblical biography. You see, the biblical biographer is concerned with pointing you to God. The worldly biographer is concerned with pointing you to the man. He's wanting to focus your attention on the details of his personality and his character. Not so the biblical. It only brings out the personality and the character insofar as it is going to illuminate the work of God. So that's the first thing which makes for the difference between the worldly and the Christian biography. The second is because the Bible never attempts to hide the blemishes. Notice that the first recorded act of Moses is one that shows his weakness. Verse 11 and 12, he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people. He looked this way and that, and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. Murder. I put a teasing problem to Mr. Hall the other day. I told him that the man who was the great lawgiver, who said that capital punishment was necessary for any murderer, was also a murderer himself who got away scot-free. How do you work that one out? Well, I leave that to you too. I haven't got a solution myself. But that's how this story begins. It describes a murderer. Not exactly a way to make your hero look exciting in the eyes of the readers, but that's how it begins. When W.E. Sangster, the great Methodist preacher, was dying, he was dying of cancer of the throat and he'd lost his voice, he called for his son and he wrote on a paper, because he couldn't speak, "They tell me that someone is going to write a biography of me." His son nodded. He went on, I deeply doubt the value of it, but if anyone must do it, it must be you. And then the son nodded again, and so he went on. Nothing must be left out. You must portray me, warts and all. Of course, he was thinking of how Cromwell, when he had his portrait painted by a rather flattering artist, flung the portrait back, saying, you've left out my warts. When you turn to the biblical biography, you'll find that the warts and the blemishes are never omitted. In fact, some of these biblical characters come out looking really rather shabby. There's a Latin tag which says, De mortuis nil nisi bonum. And in case your Latin is not up to the standard that is required for GCE A-levels or whatever it is, that means, speak nothing but good about the dead. But that's not what the Bible does. It speaks a lot of bad about the dead. Tells us exactly how feeble they were. Was Moses marvelous? The answer from the Bible is no, he wasn't. He was a very feeble man in many ways. You see his weakness horribly exposed. Look at Elijah. Was he a great man? You see him running away from Queen Jezebel, saying in the desert, O Lord, take away my life. What about David? Commits a murder, commits adultery. Great men. What about Peter? You see him denying Christ 3 times in the temple. You see, the Bible doesn't whitewash these things. We'd rather like to have a man who could be held up as a marvelous hero. This is the sort of person we like in life. This is how worldly biographers usually write their biographies. They try to make the man look a head and shoulders above everybody else, but the thing that the Bible seems to set out to do is to make them look, if anything, slightly below the average. Extraordinary, isn't it? But you see, this has a different purpose. The purpose of the writers here is not to try to persuade us that a man can do anything, but that God can do anything. It's not trying to show us people. It's trying to show us our Creator. So the gaps are left and the blemishes are exposed. The aim is that you should say not, what a person, but what a Lord. And I hope that that will be your feeling as you study biblical characters. If I may just again give one more illustration to show how this can be so misleading in our Christian lives, I remember very well reading a biography of John Wesley. The impression that I was left with was that this was a man in a million. Quite outstanding as a man. And moreover, the biography had left me with the impression that the secret of his achievement and his distinction was self-discipline. So that the effect on me was that I had a great ambition to be an absolutely distinctive, outstanding Christian like John Wesley. How was I to achieve that? Well, again, this was how I was persuaded to think. By strengthening my willpower. Now, the effect of that was, in fact, to lead me both to despair, because I found I simply could not go to bed at 11 and get up at 4 a.m. as John Wesley did. I don't know if you can. My willpower was not strong enough, and it was most distressing. But at the same time, I did manage to do some of the things he did. And I felt awfully pleased with myself. So it produced a combination of despair and self-righteousness. Sin. What a blessing it was to read a different biography. It wasn't really a biography, the memoirs of Andrew Bonner. He gives a date to various days in his life, and he then puts in diary form what had happened, his thoughts, particularly something of his prayer life. I read through that bit by bit, and it left a different effect on me. I find myself saying, I long to know God. Do you see, in the center of the picture was not man. It was God. In one case, the biographer had used a Christian as a screen by which my Lord was concealed. In the other case, he had used a Christian as a window through which my Lord could be admired. That's the difference between biblical and worldly biography. Watch for that as you read the books on the bookstall. See which impression you're left with. I was speaking on Tuesday at a meeting, and I believe on the night before somebody prayed, grant that we may see not the speaker but Christ. The prayer was rather too literally fulfilled. The room was so dark that the speaker couldn't be seen. But I'm not sure that that was necessary, quite what it was meant. And yet this is certainly what the Bible intends us to be able to do, to see Christ through men, not men in the center of the picture. Now, as we look at the life of Moses, I think one thing is dealt with, and that is the conviction that some people are born holy and somehow find Christian things easier than others. Moses, in many ways, had every disadvantage. And I want to take two main disadvantages and just look at them, because I think they're relevant to our lives, and they show something of the issues before every one of us. And they're most encouraging, really, because they show how the grace of God can work in spite of difficulties. Now, Moses did have many advantages in life, and those advantages turned out to be disadvantages, as so often. And here is, I think, our first warning. Do you long for a certain amount of luxury? Do you want to be a person of distinction? Do you hope to get to the top? Or to use the words of a writer later on in the Bible, are you seeking great things for yourself? Seek them not, he says. Because they don't make your choice easier, they make it harder. The story of Moses' birth is astonishing. It's got a lesson straight away in it. You'll find that at the end of chapter 1 of Exodus, Pharaoh, having failed to decimate the population of the Hebrews by one method, tries another. He'd begun by telling the midwives to go and to kill off all the children the moment they were born. And the midwives found an excuse for not doing this. They said, of course, our Hebrew women are tougher than your Egyptian women. They produce their babies themselves without having to bother to call the midwife. And so Pharaoh then commanded all the people, verse 22 of chapter 1, every son that is born to the Hebrews you shall cast into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live. If Pharaoh had not given that command, then Moses would not have had the kind of upbringing he did. Moses was obediently placed amongst the reeds, you find in chapter 2, verse 3, when he was getting rather large, impossible to hide. His mother took for him a basket made of bulrushes, daubed it with bitumen and pitch, and she put the child in it and placed it among the reeds at the river's brink. And as a result of doing that, Pharaoh's daughter found the child. As a result of Pharaoh's daughter finding the child, Moses was brought up in the court. Pharaoh's daughter was responsible for nurturing Pharaoh's enemy, the one who was going to be Pharaoh's undoing. Wasn't that ironical? You know, often in this world, you get the impression that evil has it all its own way. I found a book in a bookshop not far from here, written by a man, I don't know what his convictions were, simply tracing the course of evil practices in England. Very illuminating. His conclusion was fascinating because I think it's a conclusion that many people feel, but very few state. He said, we can see that evil has triumphed. It's a pessimistic thing to have to say, but the facts reveal that it's true. I'm sure that the Israelites felt just like that because they were oppressed, and they had been for 260 years. Kings had arisen who knew not Joseph. So they'd suffered. But here you see that Pharaoh is responsible for his own defeat. You can't fight against God, in fact. God doesn't fight in the same way that men fight, but he accomplishes his purposes. Isn't the cross the supreme example of that? Men come and they crush God's work. They crush God himself, and they find they've been defeated. Don't be worried if it seems that evil is triumphing. Well, now, Moses was brought up in this sort of situation. He was brought up, first of all, in Egypt. And just to get clear what that means, he was brought up in Egypt, he was brought up in the palace, and he was brought up in a life of distinction. Brought up in Egypt, what did that mean? Well, Egypt was a remarkable country. It was about 5 miles wide, if I put it that way, 500 miles long, at least Egypt proper, because there was a strip of wonderfully rich vegetation and soil down that area. 7 miles wide, 500 miles long. It was irrigated by the Nile, sweeping down from mountains in central Africa, bringing the water from the snows melting up there and from the rains. And with that water came a lot of silt, which would be carried over this stretch of ground, providing it with rich soil, natural manuring. And this is still true today. And the result was that life in Egypt was easy. If you look at the pictures in some of the tombs and pyramids, you'll find that the plows they used were light instruments. Because there was nothing much to plow. Not like Palestine, where it was so hard to plow amongst all the rocks. Hard to eke out a living. Here, a farmer could get all that he wanted with very little work. And the result was that Egypt flourished. They had a most complicated system of government. They had art, they had culture, they had education. And they had self-indulgence. And they had a sort of stagnating attitude to life, too. And isn't that so often just the problem? And that was the situation in which Moses was brought up. And isn't this the situation in which we so often find ourselves today? God has men and women today who could become leaders in coming days. Perhaps you're one. And I wonder if you're becoming enervated already by a certain amount of comfort. Your position is assured. Your income may not be increasing as sharply as you would like it to do, but nevertheless, it's increasing. Your prospects are brightening. And your soul is relaxing. You're not really seeking first the kingdom of God as strenuously as perhaps you did once. Your heart is suffering from fatty degeneration, spiritually. Perhaps not physically. And of course, that's not what God means for you. You are not made for that. A world's redemption needs you, as it needed Moses. You haven't reached the end of your course. Your time for relaxing is not going to be in this life. Moses was 40 when he began his life of activity. He was 80 when he started moving. And he went on right to the very end in the battle. But isn't it a temptation in the Christian life to say, well, you know, now I really deserve to relax a bit? I saw a chapter in a book entitled The Perils of Middle Age. Middle age can begin very young. It begins at the stage where I begin to say, well, you know, I've had it fairly tough, but now I really deserve to be able to sit back. Why, of course, when I was young, I had to put up with certain hardships and difficulties, but now I deserve. What a dangerous phrase that is. I deserve. The Christian can never really say it. Moses was brought up in Egypt, and the grace of God was able to carry him through that. Moses was brought up in the palace. Who doesn't want to be in a palace? There's something in the human heart, I believe, that longs for the honor, the praise, the recognition that you get in the royal circles. Everybody as a schoolboy or a schoolgirl dreams of going in that golden cage down the mall with the crowds cheering. If they don't actually picture themselves in that cage, they picture themselves in some similar setting as a concert pianist with the crowds roaring in the Albert Hall. Or as a footballer going and scoring goal after goal after goal while the crowd goes hysterical with delight and the rattles wave and the names come out in the headlines on the newspaper. Everybody has something of that sort in their heart. And Moses had that kind of start to life. That's what it was like being in the palace. He was also at the top. We don't know much about those years between when he was drawn out of the water and when he looked on the burdens of the people. But Stephen, in his speech in Acts chapter 7, tells us that they were not idle years. If you like to turn back to Acts chapter 7, verse 22, you'll see that. Just gives us a little picture of what was happening during those 40 years. He was not sitting back on a comfortable couch in the palace doing nothing. Slaves waving palm leaves in front of his face. The usual picture of the Eastern potentate's harem and so on. And Moses was instructed in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, and he was mighty in his words and his deeds. He was not idling. Almost certainly he went to the University of Heliopolis. It had 10,000 students. It was as big as Oxford or Cambridge. It had the same sort of tradition. People came to there from all over the known world. And he excelled. He was a student. He became a statesman. Josephus tells us that he was noted for his oratory. Surprising that, especially in view of what he says later about himself. He was a soldier. Josephus again tells us that he took an Egyptian army against the Ethiopian city of Meroe. And with brilliant strategy, he captured it. With amazing bravery, he was amongst the foremost of his troops in entering the city at great risk to himself. I don't know, that's only a tradition. Mighty in words and deeds, student, statesman, soldier, right at the top. Then he made his choice. We're told that he weighed in the balances the comfort in life, the honor in life, the position in life. That was one scale, and the other scale, God. Which did he choose? God. Well, you see, I made that choice years ago. You still making that choice? You've got to keep up that choice. It's one thing to make it once, it's another thing to continue to have that choice all the way through. That came into his heart, and then there came the day when it was a case of action. And the action that he took revealed the direction which he was going. He was out with his charioteer, I suppose, one of the smart chariots from the palace, with the royal crown on the front. And he came up and he saw the people of Israel. And he identified himself with the people of Israel. And we're told he was burdened. He looked on their burdens. He began to see what they were suffering. And his heart went out to them. And one thing concerned him, that he might in some way alleviate their burdens. And then he saw a case of gross injustice, an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, perhaps because he was too weak to do the work he was supposed to do, or because he had no straw for his bricks. He couldn't produce the bricks quick enough, and so the Egyptian was beating him. And Moses boiled, and he knew this was going to risk his whole career. He knew that this was going to perhaps put him out of favor altogether in the court. He knew that this might be the end of his happy life, but he stepped down out of his chariot and he killed the Egyptian. A wrong action, a hasty action, but what a tremendous attitude and motive behind it. He had to learn a lot about how God was going to work in his life, but he had the right concern. And as a result of that, what happened? Instead of Egypt, he had the desert. Instead of the palace, he had a tent. Instead of honor, he became a non-entity. And everybody has to be prepared for that in their hearts. What is it that matters most? Look at Hebrews chapter 11, and you'll see exactly what Moses was doing. Here the writer takes us right to the core of it. You see in verse 24 of Hebrews 11 what he says about Moses. By faith, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to share ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He considered abuse suffered for the Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, for he looked to the reward. You see, he got his eyes on a different object from those objects which other people were looking at. What are your eyes on? What goes wrong in Christians' lives all too frequently? Their eyes get onto something other than Christ. It may be a possible home that they're looking forward to, because they've now got the money to buy something better. It may be a partnership. It may be a rise in salary. It may be a happy marriage. Maybe a new gadget. Maybe another car. Grossly basic objects. But don't they so often fill the vision of even the Christian? Or again, it may be a more spiritual object. To be in the limelight, as a Christian, of course. To be noted as a person who's really influencing other people's lives. Or to be a Christian leader. And they have lost the ability to compare that object with Christ. But that's what Moses was doing all the time. He was comparing the life in Egypt, the life in the palace, the life at the top, with life with God. And he knew perfectly well which he chose. Do you still choose the right one? I was talking to a man who, in many ways, seemed to have the world at his feet about 10 years ago. He'd got an outstanding mind. He was a very fine Christian leader, a remarkable preacher, a person who many thought would go a long way, and then he was struck with a disease. And it's crippled him. He can't even walk properly now. He told me that he's never been so happy in his life. He said because God has taught him what it means to be a fool for his sake. He says he's discovered that it's greater riches having Christ than having everything else in the world. Sometimes he says as he walks along the street he stumbles and looks rather like a drunken man because he can't control his leg fully, one of them. And yet he said, you know, it makes me realize just exactly how much I love Jesus. Well, perhaps in his case, it was not so much a choice as Moses' case, but nevertheless, he's made the choice which has turned him into a man who might have been bitter, into a man who is full of joy, full of love. That was the first difficulty Moses had to face, and let's look at the second quickly. I'm sorry I've left so little time for it. The difficulty of his temperament. The difficulty of his background, but the difficulty of his temperament. You see that particularly in this incident which took place. When he saw the Egyptian, what was his immediate reaction? He boiled with anger. He let himself go. He stuck the knife into him, or he strangled him, or whatever method he used. I don't know. It doesn't tell us exactly how he committed this murder. The daily papers, no doubt, had a full account when the body was unearthed from the sand a little time later. But it doesn't come into the biblical record. It wasn't very important. But you see what happened. He said, I'm called to be God's deliverer. I will start delivering God's people. Entirely self. He didn't realize God didn't work that way. There was pride. There was passion. There was what you might call activism in his attitude. Here was Moses' weakness. Here was why he was a failure. He'd got all the abilities, and he thought that with all his abilities he could do God's work, and he discovered he couldn't. If you think that Moses' greatness came because he'd got that sort of background, because he'd had that kind of education, because he was that sort of strong character, you're completely wrong. One thing Christ, God, had to teach him was that his abilities counted for nothing. In fact, here you see something that God has to teach us. The greater the difficulties of your temperament, the greater the possibilities for his work. Moses had everything against him by temperament. Pride, passion, activism. You say, of course, if only I wasn't such a lazy person, I could be a wonderful Christian. If only I didn't have such a temper, why, I could live this Christian life much more easily. If only I had a stronger will, then I could live the Christian life better. How foolish. That weakness is your capacity. It's your greatest strength. If you'll allow God to fit it. Everybody has, as it were, a sort of bump somewhere in their life. You know how some pots have a sort of bump in them. It's supposed to add to the beauty, but of course it can be a nuisance if you knock against it. Now, everybody has in their life some sort of bump, but that bump is specially made so that God can fill you out in that way. Moses had no self-control. So Moses is the man whom God could make the most self-controlled of all men. He became the meekest man on the earth. Peter was a man who was utterly impetuous. You could never rely on him. So Christ said, right, you're the man whom I can make most rock-like. Your weakness is your capacity for God's strength. Have you learned that lesson? Well, Moses did. And there came a day when he was walking across the desert, and he suddenly saw the most extraordinary sight, a bush burning. Just like many other bushes, with one difference. It kept on burning. And this is what attracted him. There was fire there, and the bush was not consumed, and yet the fire went on burning. And I believe that not only did Moses then hear the voice of God, but he suddenly saw something of what God was saying to him. He's saying, look, you see, this bush is no different from any of the others. You're really no different from the rest of the world. Your advantages mean absolutely nothing. But you see, the moment there is a fire burning in that bush, a man stops and looks. You're an ordinary man, Moses, but the moment there's a fire burning in you, people will stop and look. Your abilities count for nothing. Your background counts for nothing. Your achievements count for nothing. But if you will allow me to start consuming you, why then you can be my deliverer. I found some words written by Oswald Sanders. They go as follows. I saw a human life ablaze for God. I felt a power divine. As through a human vessel of frail clay, I saw God's glory shine. Then woke I from a dream and cried aloud, my Father, give to me the blessing of a life consumed, that I may live for thee. Moses, as God spoke to him and said, I want you to go and be a deliverer, made every sort of excuse. He said he lacked prestige, he lacked a message, he lacked authority, he lacked eloquence, he lacked special adaptation, he lacked success. Wait a moment. He didn't lack any of those things. He got everything. Yes, he did. You see, he learned that those abilities which he'd got from the world didn't count for anything in the work of God. He had to start all over again. That's why he became God's man. Because he chose to become completely God's man. Are you prepared to be that? You one who's weighed in the balances what the world offers and what God offers. Have you seen your own weaknesses and God's strength? Will you allow yourself to be consumed by him? That's the supreme choice. And that's what so many men and women in the Christian world are not prepared to do. They'll start and go a little way, but they don't want to be consumed. They don't want to be ablaze. Let us pray. Thank you, Father, that in the life of Moses we can see your glory. Grant that in our lives, too, the same may happen. Enable us to see you so clearly that we can see those other things which so easily become the objects of our admiration and our ambition. Keep us from seeking after the wrong thing. Grant, too, that we may see that our weakness can become our strength if you are in it. And may we become consumed by the fire of your presence for the glory of your name. Amen.